So welcome everybody for to this evening's event. My name is Dimitri Vayanos and I'm a professor of finance at the LSE and director of the LSE Financial Markets Group. I'm extremely pleased to welcome Eduard Altman to the LSE. So Eduard Altman has had a very extremely distinguished career in finance. He's now a professor emeritus at NYU, at the Stern School of Business, and director of the Credit and Fixed Income Research Program at the NYU Salomon Center. He's famous for the Altman Z-score models, which are used to predict bankruptcy and are used extremely widely around the world by an extremely broad set of institutions, by investment firms and hedge funds to predict financial distress of firms they may invest in, by banks to evaluate the credit risk of their portfolios and to manage credit risk. So Professor Altman has received a wealth of distinctions, too long to list here. Among other things, he was named laureate 1984 by the Institut Commercial Foundation in Paris for all his work on corporate distress prediction models, and awarded the Graham and Dodd Scroll for 1985 by the Financial Analysts Federation for his work on default rates and high yield debt. So anyway, he's has been a founding executive editor of the Journal of Banking and Finance, and serves on the editorial board of many other leading finance journals. So we're really... last but not least, he has a connection to the LSE because he has been teaching on the TRIOM program between that involves LSE, NYU, and HEC Paris. So, and in fact, he has been the only person who has been teaching that program since the beginning. And actually, we have some alums here from TRIOM. So anyway, so we're really truly delighted to have him here to talk to us about, Altman Z-score models. So the title of his talk is 50 Years of Altman Z-score, What Have We Learned, and the Applications in Financial and Managerial Markets, a topic that's extremely relevant these days. So, let me not say anything more about that. Let me just say a few things about logistics. So the, for Twitter users, the hashtag for today's event is hashtag LSE Altman. So if you're tweeting, please use that tonight. Please put your phones on silent. The event is being recorded. As you can see, there's a camera there, my right. And we'll plan to make it available as a podcast and video. So we also have a photographer here to capture the event, and we'll make a selection of photos available on our website. If for some reason you don't want to be in the images, please let us know in advance that we will publish on our website. And same for the, if you want to be in the record, don't want to be in the recording, please choose to sit behind the camera. What else? If you hear an alarm and are instructed to leave the building, please do so immediately. We don't expect any alarm, so don't worry, but just in case. And actually, the way we're going to run this lecture is that Professor Altman will be talking, and then there will be questions and by the audience at any point in the talk. So you can just sort of, we'll make it kind of more free-flowing as opposed to just taking questions at the end. So, when you want to ask a question, please ask for a microphone. So I think I said all I had to say. Please join me in welcoming Professor Altman.
Thank you. You can sit down. Thank you very much, Dimitri. Thank you all for coming tonight. It's always a great pleasure to visit foreign universities, but also partners, as you said, in our TRIOM program. And thank you for the TRIOM group that they like to sit up front so that make sure that I see them, and it's a pleasure to be with you again. Thank you, Elizabeth, for helping to pave the way for this talk this evening. I think I probably am the only one since the beginning of 2003, class of 2003, TRIUM. Now it's a very important part of our program. It's actually our flagship global executive MBA and ranked one of the best in the world, mainly because of our partners. And so we're very pleased to be with you. And Dimitris mentioned something about an alarm. So sometimes there's a fire alarm here. Is that what you're talking about? Or some other, hopefully no other types of alarms. But actually, I arranged a big conference in New York about 3 weeks ago. And we had about 750 registrants and about 500 people who were there. And after 15 minutes of the conference, the alarms went off. Fire alarms, noise, blinking lights. And I was one of the organizers and said, oh, this is terrible. You never know how long that's going to last. This could mess up the timing because it was a very precise conference from 9 a.m. until 5:30 p.m. And this could be a disaster. And people started looking at each other to the left and the right and said, do we really have to get up? I mean, and so one of my colleagues went outside and said, yes, it's a real alarm. Everybody has to leave the building. I said, oh, my God. And so people started getting up. And there are two small exits in the back, 500 people, you know, rushing to the exits at the same time. We have a name for that in finance, of course. Then after a very short time, fortunately, they said, oh, no, it's just a drill, and you don't have to leave the building after all. And I was so happy. But it also reminded me of a true story that I'd like to tell you. How many of you remember last January there was a missile alert in Hawaii of incoming missiles from North Korea? You may remember that. Probably being here in London or wherever you were, it didn't resonate with you. But I was there. Every January I go to Hawaii with my family and friends, and I stay for a while to warm up because it's a cold season in New York. And so I was in Hawaii, and I'm an honorary member, but also I like to go with this group every Saturday morning for breakfast. And it was a Saturday morning. And the group is known as the Romeos. Stands for Retired Old Men Eating Out. And the Romeos were having their breakfast. And then the cell phones started going off. Missile alert, missile alert. This is a true story. I'm not making it up. And people looking around, you know, looking, deciding what to do. You know, what do you do if there's a incoming missile? You know, what are you going to do anyway? And the Romeos, well, the average age is about 80, maybe higher than that. I'm a little bit younger than the average, but not much. And, you know, we've all had pretty good lives, you know, comfortable. So they asked me, what do you think we should do? And I said, I wonder if they have any vodka here. And we found out, no, I'm sorry, they didn't have any vodka. But the really classic line, this is a true story, one of my Romeo colleagues said, well, maybe we should wait before paying the bill. True story. When you think about it, it's kind of an absurd statement because either way, it's not going to work. But that's a true story. It has. Thank you for Dimitri for mentioning the alarm, because it's not the first time I've told the story, because I told it that day at the conference. The conference that I was talking about, and perhaps we have some questions, not only on the material that you're going to hear, but also on the subject of where we are in the credit cycle and what's the outlook for credit markets in the future. Credit happens to be one of the areas that I have researched in. Of course, the main area and the subject of our lecture this evening is 50 years. It's actually now 51 years when we published the first version of the Z-score model article in the Journal of Finance now 51 years ago. So poetic license, we still refer to it as 50 years. Let's see. Okay. So the subject has to do with this 50-year journey. And I'd like to share it with you. Interestingly enough, I gave a similar talk yesterday at a conference. Was it yesterday? Yes, yesterday at a conference here in London, but I only had 30 minutes to give the talk. And I've been told by Dimitri we're here until midnight together. Is that okay? Because I think I need that much time. No, just kidding. But I'll be here until up to 2 hours and take your questions. And as he said, any questions during the subject, during the talk, is welcome. I always find that waiting to the end to ask your question is kind of ridiculous. The question is relevant to something someone says a half hour or an hour ago. Why wait till the end to ask the question when it maybe is no longer that important, or at least not relevant, or everyone else has forgotten, you know, what you were talking about half hour ago? So don't hesitate to ask a question as we go through the talk. But also, you can wait until the end if you want to be feeling that it's more polite to do so. Okay, so I guess we have two screens up there. I will also talk about a number of applications that I've observed over the years, I've experienced, and indeed others have experienced and have recommended to me, perhaps it is another application perhaps that I didn't think about. So first, a little bit of an academic background about scoring systems or distress prediction models. Some of it I'll go through more detail than I normally have time to do, and others I'll go quickly through it. So scoring systems or credit risk models or bankruptcy prediction models, they all have the same objective. Ultimately, is to guide the decision maker as to whether or not a company is likely to default, perhaps repay their loan or not, or for other reasons that you're interested in doing a credit analysis on the company. And the beginning of this journey of credit scoring models, not the Z-score, but the credit scoring models, at least in the United States, goes back a couple of centuries, to the time when the country was expanding westward and it was necessary to raise capital for companies to finance their opening and their growth as the company, as the country moved westward. My guess is that, in fact, there was a professor at NYU. His name was Desmond Fitzgerald. I don't know if any of you have ever heard of him, but he's British. I think he's still in London, but I'm not sure. I've lost track with him. But anyway, he used to teach a course on Renaissance finance. This is kind of an interesting topic. He talks about credit worthiness assessment going back to the days of the Crusades, when people had to journey from, London or Paris or wherever to Turkey. And along the way, of course, they needed to stay in inns or whatever lodgings they could find, but they didn't want to carry money with them because there were pirates along the way. So they needed to have letters of credit to show to the inn manager that, in fact, that they could pay their bill if they were billed that, because they didn't have the cash or whatever the equivalent was with them. But in my experience, it goes back to the 1800s. But in those days, they There were no databases, there were no financial statements, there was no audited statements, and so companies would borrow money using their history of payment, or the fact that they've been in business for a certain number of years, the quality of their product, something about the industry, the location, and these were very qualitative factors. Well, interestingly enough, and that was very primitive, and the decision-making process was quite primitive as well, but it worked enough to finance these companies. But ironically, we've come almost full circle, where today, with the advent of machine learning and extensive databases, but also with social media and with other forms of non-quantitative data that is now becoming more and more available, that these types of variables, which were primitive back in the 1800s, are now being used again to enhance the type of models that I built 50 years ago and others have been utilizing over the years, the quantitative models, to enhance the predictive accuracy of the type of credit scoring models that have been built. So it's kind of an interesting full circle. And so that was in the 1800s. And then around the beginning of the 20th century, 1909 for Moody's and 1916 for Standard & Poor's, we had the advent of rating agencies. And so we had the usual nomenclature for a rating agency, and that is the investment grade and non-investment grade categories from AAA down to CCC. The non-investment grade area, or another name for that is high yield bonds or junk bonds, which, by the way, was not in existence back in the early 20th century, except occasionally the rating agencies which established these ratings to try to assess the likelihood of repayment of interest on bonds and loans later on, oftentimes would have a company rated below investment grade, say double B or single B, but they were all fallen angels. So a fallen angel is a company that is investment grade at birth, but like most of us, as we get older, we get uglier. We lose our hair, we develop wrinkles, and sometimes we get downgraded from investment grade or from whatever we were to non-investment grade. And that's called a fallen angel. And that's the only type of non-investment grade bonds there were over the years until the late 1970s, early 1980s, when Michael Milken and Drexel Burnham discovered the and pioneered the original issue junk bonds, which now is a big industry globally. And I'll go through those numbers with you later on, but they exist now all over the world, primarily in the U.S. and in Europe. I estimate globally there's about $3 trillion worth of high-yield bonds. And if you add the loan counterpart of leveraged loans, probably another $2 to $3 trillion. So you're talking about a $5 to $6 trillion leverage finance market from traditional sources like bonds and loans. And now we have so-called shadow banking or non-bank lending, which is getting quite large also. And indeed, we have many conferences about this right now. So that was what happened. And these rating agencies helped pioneer the use of univariate individual measures of creditworthiness of companies based on things like liquidity, profitability, leverage, and so on. And the rating agencies are still doing this. Indeed, I sit on the advisory board of one, and now it might be a second rating agency. And although they are all quite knowledgeable about more sophisticated models that are out there for estimating default probabilities, they still use these traditional techniques and publish things like I don't know if you can see these numbers. It's not too important that you get the exact numbers. But on the left-hand side, you have a list of maybe 8 or 9 financial measures. And then in the body of the matrix, you have median levels for various rating classes, AAA down to CCC. So, for example, a very commonly important univariate measure of creditworthiness is the one second from the bottom, debt to EBITDA. That's the debt of a company divided by its earnings before interest and taxes plus depreciation, etc. And that ratio ranges from only 0.4 times for AAA as much as 8.6 times for CCC. And there are some rules of thumb out there that regulators use, rating agencies use, practitioners use, that say anytime you go above 5 or 6, you're into a likely distressed situation. And these rules of thumb are generally thought to be pretty accurate for delineating across risk classes. And so we publish these, or they publish these, for the U.S., and they also publish them for Europe, Middle East, and Africa, so-called EMEA companies. And these are guidelines that have been used over the years by investment banks, by practitioners, to help estimate to a company, for example, what rating they will get if they issued a bond. Because it's very easy to calculate it for a company and fit it into looking like a AA or a single A or BBB company and so on. And this is the so-called univariate, one measure at a time technique that has been around now for now about 100 years. Then, in the mid-1960s, I entered the scene, so to speak. Now, I'd like to bring you back now 50-plus years to give you a little picture of what it was like to do financial research 50 years ago. Now, that seems like an awfully long time for many people. In fact, some people who hear me talk and have studied the Z-score since they went to school themselves, but they are along in the years, they say, well, is he still alive? Now, is it really, I studied that 45 years ago when I was a student myself. Well, a point that I'd like to make is, back then, if you wanted to do some statistical analysis that was more than just a one measure at a time analysis, if you were a graduate student, as I was, at UCLA back in the early 1960s, you would have had to use handheld calculators, abacus, something very primitive, and if you were really smart, you could probably convert that into some sort of correlation analysis between financial distress and ratios. But it was very difficult. But then I was very lucky, because I was at UCLA at a time when mainframe computers first became available for financial and social science research in general. Before that, yes, there were computers available, but they were mainly for the medical sciences, the physical sciences, and probably the government. But they weren't available on college campuses. So I'm convinced if I was a student, say in 1963, 64, and I was writing my dissertation, that I couldn't have done the multivariate analysis that I ended up doing. And if I was a student 2 or 3 years later, probably someone else would have done it. So there's a very important lesson on this, I think, and it has to do with timing. Timing in life is really important. In fact, Malcolm Gladwell wrote a book. Some of you may have heard of it, but I recommend you read it if you haven't. It's called The Outliers. I don't know if any of you have read it. It's a really little tiny book. You can probably read it in a couple of days at most. And its main theme was breakthroughs, creativity, advances are very much a function of when you were born and what age you were when you got to the point that you were either doing research or you were creating a new idea or starting a new experiment. And you had the facilities around you and the environment that was nurturing for that experiment. And you think about a lot of breakthroughs, you know, they were generally done early on, but if they waited a little while, somebody else would have done it. Now, I'm convinced that that was the case for my little experiment back in the mid-1960s. And at that time, the state of the art was this univariate analysis, one measure at a time. But the problem with that kind of analysis was very clear, that there was no standard for what you could use to determine if a firm would go bankrupt. You could be at the bottom of the list in 10, 20, 30 different measures that you looked at, but it still wouldn't tell you the probability of default, and it certainly wouldn't even tell you if you would default or not, just that you were at the bottom, and you were more risky maybe than someone else that was in the middle or at the top. Also, the measures that were used then did not have any weightings as to which one were more important. So how did you know that the return on assets deserved a different weight than, say, the debt equity ratio with respect to whether or not a company was going to default or not? And finally, if you did use weightings, and we all, by the way, in our own decision-making process, use implicit subjective weights, whether we realize it or not, based on our experience, you know, what books we have read, who we studied under, what lectures we heard, perhaps if we work for a bank, what was the bank training program telling us? And we use all our experiences to implicitly give relative weightings to data. The problem with that is it's subjective. And my weightings is going to be different than your weightings. And who's better? Well, maybe sometimes you're better, maybe sometimes I'm better. And who is more accurate? Well, there's no criteria for that unless you can, you know, replicate that many, many times. So that was the state of the art when we first decided to build a multivariate analysis using a number of measures all at the same time. Sorry, not all at the same time, but parsimoniously selecting a group of measures that were analyzed simultaneously, and the computer algorithm that we used to discriminate between healthy and unhealthy clients, companies, etc., was based on having the highest accuracy level for the sample that you've chosen. I'll come back to that theme in a moment. So that was what we did back in 1968, the Z-score model. Since then, there have been many, many, many articles and books. If you looked at the literature as to how many bankruptcy prediction models that were spawned after our study, it's probably in the thousands, using different types of techniques, Loggit analysis, probit analysis, now machine learning, before that in artificial intelligence. Many, many different ways to skin a cat, and the cat being to assess the probability of default of an enterprise or an individual. All of us, when we go to a bank now and want to borrow money, we're going to be scored. The most common one is called a FICO score, and it stands for a company that pioneered this called Fair Isaacs. So at least in the United States, I don't know in the UK, everybody has a FICO score who has attempted to borrow money. And that FICO score travels with you, whether you like it or not. And the next time you try to borrow, or it doesn't even have to be for borrowing money, it could be just for guarantees or whatever, everyone has a FICO score. So that was a consumer model. There have been manufacturing firm models, extensions for specific industries. Our original model, and I want you to keep that in mind when we talk about application, was built only with manufacturing companies, publicly held, so the data was publicly available. And generally at that time, they were smaller companies compared to today's bankruptcies. And we had two groups, bankrupt and non-bankrupt. They were non-overlapping, unambiguous groups, so it was easy to know where a company fits in. And they were used for many other purposes, like emerging markets, banks, and most recently, I and my colleagues here from a firm called Wiser Funding here in London have concentrated on small and medium-sized firms using similar techniques that we use for Z-Score and enhancing it with machine learning, with qualitative data, with macroeconomic data, and I'll say more about that a little later on. So that's one class of models that is still around today, even though we first discovered it, so to speak, 50-plus years ago. Other types of models that have been built, and maybe some of you have studied this in your financial classes, are option contingent claim models. The most famous one of this type is the so-called Merton model, named after Robert Merton in his work in 1974, part of which helped him win the Nobel Prize in economics. And that was using option pricing theory and distance to default analysis in order to estimate the probability of default of a company's on their risky debt. Now, let me give you the intuition of that kind of model instead of going through, I don't even have it on the PowerPoint, the mathematics behind it. So you have a company with a certain level of assets and a certain level of liabilities. And the whole issue in this case is to estimate the likelihood that that level of assets will over time fall below the level of liabilities. Very simple. If assets are less than liabilities, the firm is insolvent in an economic sense. The breakthrough in this case, however, was how do you measure the level of assets? It's pretty easy to measure the level of liabilities. Just look at the balance sheet in terms of the book value of the liabilities and what has to be repaid. But the level of assets is a book value, and it's not very helpful in terms of the economic value of those assets. So Merton and others have pioneered the use of market value as estimates of value of assets, and the market value of equity in particular plays a very important role, especially for publicly traded companies, as to that level of assets, the level of equity plus debt compared to the level of debt. And the most important aspect of the equity value is its volatility. So the historic volatility of equity becomes very important for estimating the likelihood of default. It's kind of an interesting idea. It's pretty easy now to imagine that that is an important variable, but back in 1970s, it wasn't. And people were didn't look very much at market equity as a measure. By the way, it's not a perfect measure. There's all sorts of problems with market value of equity as a measure of credit risk. For one thing, it's very volatile. Does the value of a company's assets change every day? Because certainly it's going to change if you use market value. And can you use it in Brazil? Can you use it in China? Can you use it in the UK? Can you use it in Afghanistan as a measure of risk? And so markets are very different, particularly in developing countries, to use as a measure of risk. Anyway, those option contingent claim models or distance to default models have been used quite a bit in academic research, and there was one firm called KMV which monetized or commercialized that theoretical breakthrough and was very successful, and it's still being used today. It's a subsidiary of Moody's called KMV, that's being used today as a separate measure. It doesn't filter into, at least Moody's says this in their decision on ratings. Artificial intelligence systems have been a fascination of researchers and practitioners over the last 30 or 40 years using expert systems. I've used it for neural network analysis, and now most recently the buzzword is machine learning. So what the hell is machine learning? It's certainly very popular among PhD students throughout the world. But what really is that? Well, we called it something else 20 years ago. We called it data mining. We were trying to mine data to reach better decisions. But data mining is not as sexy as machine learning and never really caught on beyond a small group of researchers. But actually, I think back, and I actually didn't even know it at the time, but I was part of a research group at NYU, and we used a technique called recursive partitioning analysis. Probably you never heard of it because it never really caught on. It got us a couple of publications, so that's nice, but you know that doesn't mean much to the world except to the people who wrote the articles. And so, recursive partitioning was like machine learning because what we did is we built a series of models, kind of in a decision tree analysis, in order to reach a final nodule that was the final decision as to whether or not a firm would default or non-default. We didn't call it machine learning. We didn't call it data mining. We just said it was recursive partitioning, which is part of a family of classification techniques. Today, the state of the art is primarily what's called hybrid models. So you will find a number of practitioners, some academics, using hybrid models which combine financial data, qualitative data, macroeconomic data. Indeed, at Wiser Funding, and my colleague here, Gabriele Sabato, is right here, we have developed these kind of models using those types of module analyses to assess the creditworthiness of small and medium-sized firms by country, by sector, throughout the world, but primarily starting in Europe. And these types of models now are becoming more and more accurate because of this combination of financial data, qualitative data, machine learning, and macroeconomic factors all together analyzed to come up with an assessment of credit risk. And so the reintroduction of qualitative factors, full circle. Any questions on this history? I know I'm leaving out some other types of pretty powerful mathematical techniques that have been used. Genetic algorithms. What do we use? I built a model in Italy in the late 1990s. Trying to remember the I'll think of it maybe later on. And it wasn't an Italian name, but it was based on Italian data. Okay. Now, this is an estimate of the size of that leveraged finance market I talked about before. And the reason why I emphasize it now is if you are going to do testing on bankruptcy and default prediction models, the most relevant application is the companies that have considered to be higher risk and higher return instruments like high-yield bonds. So if you look at the top part of this analysis, the top graph, you can see back, and you can't see the numbers because I can barely see it from here, but in the early years of the high-yield bond market, the size was about $10 billion, and I was very fortunate in 1982 to be asked by an investment bank, Morgan Stanley, to assess for them whether or not they should get their hands dirty, so to speak, with this new market called junk bonds. Because at that time, it was a tiny little market, and it was only these fallen angels. But investment banks then began to be jealous of this newcomer on the block, so to speak, called Drexel Burnham, which was pioneering coming to market with these heretofore too risky, too small, too obscure companies issuing bonds directly to the public, and they were non-investment grade. Interestingly enough, here again, timing is so important. I was really lucky to be asked in 1982, being the first academic, to study this market for a very practical purpose, whether or not Morgan Stanley should get involved in this. Think about getting involved in the underwriting of higher risk company bonds. Well, there's always the risk that you can't sell the bonds or that they'll default very quickly and the market will evaporate very quickly. But back then, the tantalizing fact was companies would charge, underwrote those bonds, spreads like 3% on the outstanding amount, making a lot of money to come to the public, especially if the market size was large. Anyway, it worked, and it grew over time, and today it's $1.7 trillion. In Europe, the market developed much later. Since 2009, 2010 has grown a lot, and it's now over 500 billion euros. The main reason why it has grown so much in Europe is very simple. Banks stopped lending to non-investment grade companies because of the amount of capital they would have to hold for reserves and for capital requirements, and also because the banks themselves were quite weak and have been weak ever since the great financial crisis of 2008-2009. And so high yield bonds has to some extent filled the vacuum left by banks. And the same thing is happening now to financing of small and medium-sized firms, as banks, at least until recently, have left that market and left it up to non-banks, so-called shadow banks, to fill that market. And it's working, but keep in mind that this new innovation called lending to SMEs by non-banks has never been tested in a downturn. So keep your eyes on the next downturn and what happens to the shadow banks in the system, as well as what happens to the banks. I predict it'll be in 14 months and 6 days that this will happen. That's a joke. But I don't know, but I think it's going to be between 1 and 2 years from now that we'll see a major downturn in the credit cycle. And check, yes, Luke.
Of money and capital to the shadow banks. Yeah. Was that risk there?
The question was, who was contributing the capital to shadow banks for making the loans, whether they be risky or not? And the answer is, there are a number of them. First of all, especially in this market of low default rates, hedge funds, which normally would be investing in distressed securities, for example, are looking for higher yields by direct lending. But that's not the main one. There is a group of companies called BDCs, Business Development Corporations, primarily in the US, but increasingly outside. And they raise their money from three sources. First, limited partnerships, just like any hedge fund. So say a wealthy individual or college endowment or a pension fund or a mutual fund wants to look for higher yield, and they can do it through direct investment in a hedge fund. They're called limited partners, and they share in the profits, and they're sometimes guaranteed a certain minimum rates of return. Second, equity financing. So a company is listed, it's called a BDC, raises money from the equity markets. Yes, they generally pay a high dividend, but they say the dividend is 3, 4, 5, 6%, maybe even higher. And then they take that money, these BDCs, and lend it out to risky companies at 8, 10, 12%. And some of them even leverage up themselves. So they borrow money themselves, and they leverage that 8% return, maybe two times or three times, and they can return as much as 16, 18, 20% to their equity investors. And finally, insurance companies. So an insurance company that writes life insurance, for example, well, how do they exist? Well, they take your premium and they invest it. And they invest it in common stocks and bonds, investment grade, government bonds. But in this low interest rate environment, they're saying, hey, maybe we should invest it in these direct lending indirectly by putting our money into the BDCs. So those are three sources of funds, and there are others for the shadow banks making loans. And we estimate in the U.S. that the shadow banking industry is between $500 and $700 billion. I don't know what it is in Europe. I hope, I don't know, Dimitri, if you know anybody's done any analysis on shadow banks here in the UK, for example. I know it exists. Of course, there is a lot of enterprises making loans directly. How about the peer-to-peer lending? There's a lot of that going on now. Well, how does that peer get money to lend to that peer? It could be through the internet, you know. Give me your $10 or your 10 euros or whatever. I guess pounds is what they use here. we'll lend it out to someone. You have no idea who's getting the loan. You have no idea. You're trusting that the peer lender has some sort of system for determining who to lend to. Well, in this benign credit cycle, with default rates being so low, you can do it blindly and come up reasonably well, but that's not going to be the case in the next downturn. So that's the leverage finance industry. I've talked about this. Now let's go to the original Zed model. So how many of you have studied the Zed model, or at least heard about it, maybe even seen this model before? Raise your hands, please. Okay, maybe about 37% of you. So the rest, this is new stuff. And if you've seen it before, it's not bad to see it again in the flesh, so to speak. So we have this model. Now, let me tell you how we built it. First of all, how many of you have ever heard of a punch card? Anybody have a punch card? Yeah, the gray-haired folks in the audience have all heard of punch cards. The rest of you maybe haven't, because they don't exist very much anymore, maybe not at all. But a punch card was how you did your computer work in the vintage 1960s and 70s. And what you did was you had, an experiment that you were working on, and in my case, bankrupt and non-bankrupt companies, and you gathered data, usually very primitive sources, rather than through some database or internet basis. And you gathered the data, you wrote it down on a piece of paper, and then you transferred that data onto these punch cards by punching in the punch card machine the data. You combined it with the source program, which is your discriminant or your regression or your logit analysis later on, and then you put it all together and you put it into the punch card box. And it usually was pretty heavy, so it was good for bodybuilding. And then you would physically take that box and walk across the campus to the mother computer, the mainframe that was just installed. And then you would submit your job, and then you would go to your favorite church, synagogue, or mosque and pray that you would get results. And in my case, maybe half the time you would get results, and half the time you would get a note saying, sorry, Mr. Altman, but one of the cards was bent, and we couldn't do the analysis. Or you punched the data in the wrong field. Try again. And it was very tedious because you could only try one different model each time for each box. Now you can simply press buttons and try many different variations with different variables and different samples of companies. So this model, let me give you the, since I have more time than I usually do, a little bit more description of what we did. So we had a very small sample, 66 firms of bankrupt and non-bankrupt companies. In those days, it was a different bankruptcy system, but it was pretty clear that the company was in terrible shape when it went bankrupt. And we had a control sample of non-bankrupt. They were all manufacturers. They were all publicly traded companies, so the data was available. In the United States, still to this day, different than, say, the UK, we cannot easily do data on privately held companies, models on privately held, because the data is protected. In the UK, for example, when we built our UK model, we had, how many million was it, Gabrielli? 30 million observations. Why? Because there's something called a company house and tax returns that are all publicly available, in case you didn't know it. You don't need to go to a database of publicly held companies. And so privately held companies become much more transparent to do analysis. But to this day, that's not the case in the U.S. So most of the data used for model building, in the U.S. anyway, is only on companies that are publicly held and traded. Now, fortunately, although it's, I wouldn't say it's a dying breed, but in the height of our capital markets, we had up to 10,000 companies that are publicly traded. Ladies and gentlemen, today, less than 5,000, maybe even less than 4,000, because the trend is for companies to go private who are public, mainly owned by private equity companies. And no longer is that data then on them easily available. Anyway, we started out with 66 firms, all manufacturing, and we had to decide what measures to use that could eventually end up in a bankruptcy prediction model. So being a team of one with limited resources and time, I chose 22 financial variables from the literature that was available at the time. Plus, we pioneered two types of variables that had never been used before. One is an example in X2. For some reason, the retained earnings to total assets had never been used in the literature by the rating agencies, by companies, by credit analysts, by banks before. For those of you who are not familiar with retained earnings, another name for that is earned surplus. And it measures the cumulative profitability of a company minus what? Dividends, what they've paid out. So when you think about it, the retained earnings of a company, whether they be in one industry or another, is very much a function of how successful the company has been in the past and how they've allocated those earnings and cash flows either to internal reinvestment or paid it out to their shareholders. A company that has retained a high percentage of their past profits and has invested that to grow the company's assets is going to have a very high retained earnings to total assets. A company that has used a lot of OPM, other people's money, whether it be debt or equity, probably has not had a high retained earnings to total assets. And so retained earnings to total assets is kind of a backdoor method for measuring the debt capacity of a company going forward. So if I have a lot of retained earnings relative to my assets and I want to grow the company, now I can go out and borrow money more easily than a company that has used a lot of debt in the past. Now, there are exceptions to that. Donald Trump is an exception. Somehow or other, he borrows money, he goes bankrupt, but somehow or other, he's like Houdini, he continues to borrow money even when he's dead, or his companies are dead. Yeah. You know, we have a, in the United States, we have a bankruptcy code called Chapter 11. Some of you may have read about it. And if a company goes bankrupt twice, chapter 22, and three times 33. Well, Mr. Trump is at least a 44, and maybe even higher than that. No, that's true, by the way, about his company. So, you know, but I think now he couldn't borrow a nickel from a real bank anymore. So he has to borrow from the U.S. government in the way he's doing it. So retained earnings to total assets. It is also a backdoor measure somewhat, I wouldn't say backdoor, but kind of not as obvious, about the age of a company. Think about it. A company that is young probably has not had a lot of time to build up its retained earnings. And if you looked at any statistics on failure rates, young companies fail more frequently than older companies. You know, it's just a fact. And so the higher the age of a company, the lower the probability, usually. We have some exceptions to that. So retained earnings turns out to be a very effective variable in most of the models that I've built. And it hadn't been used before, that one. The other variable that was brand new, even before Robert Merton use of it, was the fourth variable, the market equity to total liabilities. So for the first time, we used a market equity rather than a book equity to measure creditworthiness of a company. Now it's quite standard to look at market equity to debt ratios for companies. But back then, it was really quite new. Five variables. Now, keep in mind that those weighting factors, yes?
What was your thinking of using the casino in your model?
Market equity, yeah. Why did I do it? Okay, there was the question was, why did I use market equity? Did you use the word casino? Not bad. The reasons were as follows. If you think about market equity, at least in efficient markets, the market equity of any asset is a function of its expected future earnings or future cash flows, not its past, because a company that has no future is not going to have a high market equity. And after all, the model is to predict the future, whether or not a firm will go bankrupt. Second, equity values are the main ingredient for determining the cost of equity capital of a company. And the cost of equity capital combined with the cost of debt will give you the weighted average cost of capital, which is, you know, one of the criteria for investment purposes. And finally, it's a consensus. Having said that, and I think your use of the casino adjective, you imply that it's gambling. Yes, fluctuations.
2008 versus 2009.
Yeah. Now, do you think, and it's a great question, do you think a company, let's not take 2008, let's go back to 1987, October 19th. The stock market fell by over 20% in one day. So the question is, are firms 20% approximately more risky on October 20 compared to October 19. That's a very good example of volatility. One day, now firms are a lot more risky than they were the day before, if you use market equity. And I would argue, and I think maybe you would, based on your question, that no, 20% difference in one day is ridiculous. But there's no question that the cost of capital of companies increased dramatically on October 19th. And also, the criteria for investment of companies was much more difficult on October 20 than October 19. And as a result, we had the beginning of a downturn. When the required rates of return go way up, companies invest less, and the value of their company and the value of the market goes down. Having said that, I would agree that sometimes a company's credit worthiness due to market fluctuations has nothing to do with the company itself. It has to do with, you know, the market, right? Or, you know, the trade war right now between the United States and China. So every time there's a rumor that they're going to have some accommodation, the market goes up by a couple of percent, 1%, 2%, 3%. And some companies which have no relationship to the trade war will go up also, or down if the trade war rumor is proved to be nothing more than a rumor. And so you would argue, and correctly so, that that has nothing to do with the, you know, default probability of companies, but market fluctuations happen. And what about if you go to Brazil or some other countries where the stock market is considered a little bit more of a casino than it is in a more efficient company? So that's a negative also. Yeah. So we tried both book value and market value, and it turned out the market value was more helpful in predicting defaults than the book value was. But both of them were effective. Five variables measuring liquidity, cumulative profitability, profitability, leverage, and activity. How did I get those five? Trial and error. Yes, there have been computer algorithms built since, stepwise analysis for choosing the variables. I've done that too, but I didn't know much about stepwise when I built this model. And so we had 22 to start with. I wanted a model that was not so complex, and I didn't want redundancy in the variables. I didn't need three profitability variables to measure the profitability of a company. I didn't need three leverage variables. You could capture it mainly in one or two. And so it was only five-variable model, and those coefficients there, and this is the most frequent question that I get, how did I determine the coefficients? And it doesn't matter how many times I say it, I still get the same question. Well, let me say it one time and maybe even several times. I did not determine the coefficients. The computer program did. And those coefficients are unique to the variables and the sample. If I would add more firms to the sample or change the variables, the coefficients would change. So there's nothing optimal about, it's not an optimizing model, it's a satisfying model, if you will. Yes, Dimitris.
How stable are these coefficients across different time periods or different countries?
Yes, good question. And a question I get over, not only are how stable, but how normal is the, are the distribution of the variables, because that's another assumption of the statistical model, normality of the data. Well, the answer is, and by the way, I've built many models over the years, and I know that if I used new firms in the updated the sample or added other variables, that the coefficients are going to change a lot. But what I found is the relationship, the correlation between the weightings remain quite stable over time. And I don't care if the coefficients are unstable with new samples or whatever. What I care about is stability of accuracy and the relationship between how important one variable is to another remaining fairly stable. Not perfectly stable. But there's no question, if I ran that model today, same variables, but different samples, the coefficients would be different. Now, many people ask me, well, that's an old model. True. Why don't you update the model? And I'm going to show you in a minute that I don't update that model, although I build new models for different purposes. But what I'm concerned with updating the model, is that I'm going to have to communicate that to the world, that there is a new and better model. And that's very difficult with the internet. Yes, it's easy for me to communicate I have a new model, but the old models are still available and still being used and abused, which I'll get to the abuse later on, make it a little sexy, there's abusiveness in the models. And I'll come back to that question again when we talk about how we update our results using the same model and coefficients. Now, back in 1968, when we published the original model, we knew that the reader would need some guidance as to how to interpret the score. Because all you're going to get from a discriminant or a regression model is a dependent variable, the score. Now, keep in mind that in discriminant analysis, unlike regression, the dependent variable, I didn't think about putting the actual theoretical regression and discriminant functions up there, but the dependent variable is not known before you do the analysis. It's a result of the analysis. But what you do know are the groupings. Bankrupt, non-bankrupt, default, delinquent, non-default, merger, non-merger. You can use many, many different qualitative variables to determine your groupings using discriminant analysis. So the Z in the score is not something we know before we build the model. All we know are the variables of bankrupt and non-bankrupt groups, and we search for coefficients that best classify the original groupings into their correct grouping, the original firms into their correct groupings. And it's like what's called an accuracy ratio, or type 1 and type 2 error, that we use to determine how good the model is. So back then, a score didn't mean anything. What's a score of 5 or 10 or 20, which you can get? By the way, what's the highest score possible? It's kind of a trick question, but it's a real question. What is the highest score possible for a firm? I tell my students, for an A in the course, A minus, B plus. What is the highest score? Well, some people add up all the coefficients and they say it's that. No. It's kind of a trick question. The answer is infinite. Why? How can a score be infinite? Well, what variable can be infinite of the 5? X what? 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5? 4. Correct. If you have no debt, it doesn't matter the market value of equity. Even if market value of equity is 1 penny or 1 pound or whatever, with a 0 in the denominator, it's an infinite contribution. Now, when you think about it, an infinite score for a 0 amount of debt, it's pretty hard to go bankrupt if you don't have debt. And so there is some sense to having a very high score, meaning low probability of default. But the answer is most firms' scores are between minus 5 and plus 10. But it could be 50, 100, it could be 1,000, or infinite, as I said. So what does the score mean in terms of bankruptcy prediction? Well, we established these zones back then. Any score above 3, or 2.99, we classified as safe. And indeed, in the original model and in subsequent tests, it was 100% accurate back then. Any score below 1.8 was classified as bankrupt and 100% accurate again back then. And so we thought we were clever by publishing the so-called safe, gray, and gray being uncertain, but we knew the higher the score, the healthier the firm, the less likely to go bankrupt. It no longer is relevant. But if you look up on Google, you'll find it. Wikipedia, you used to find it until I finally corrected it. Textbooks, you'll find it. You'll find the zones. And to this day, I get emails, I think more hate mail sometimes, from companies and people saying, oh, we just dropped below 1.8. You know, we can't get any credit anymore because the banks all say we're going bankrupt. Or, and that's ridiculous, you know. You know, is there a difference between 1.79 and 1.81? The answer is no. They're basically the same credit worthiness, but one zone is different from the other. So even though at that time it was sensible to publish these zones, it really is a problem today. And so for this audience anyway, and every audience that I speak to, please do not use zones to determine bankruptcy likelihood. Even though it's simple to do so, because it's a nice, simple guideline, I'm going to suggest something different. But it was very accurate back then. Today, I would say 20-25% of U.S. companies have a score below 1.8, and they all don't go bankrupt. And I'll show you in a moment that the average score of a B-rated company today is below 1.8, and they don't all go bankrupt or default. Now, why are those zones no longer relevant? There's been a massive migration in credit risk over the last 50 years. Back 50 years ago, 40 years ago, there was no such things as junk bonds or leveraged loans. Now, it's a big industry and a big market. 50 years ago, there was much less competition. If you had a new product, you had much less competition. Even though now today you can sell your product globally, but also you have the possibility and the likelihood that if you have a nice idea, that there's other people, not only in your country, but throughout the world, that have a similar idea to sell a new product. My son had an idea to import cacao beans for chocolate in the U.S. Well, he looked on the internet, and there were hundreds of companies that did that already. So it wasn't such a unique idea after all, as an example. More and larger bankruptcies. I ask this question sometimes, but take a guess. Most of you do not live or know about the United States probably too much in terms of this question, but take a guess anyway. How many billion-dollar companies, and I'm talking about liabilities, billion-dollar liabilities companies go bankrupt every year on average, say for the last 20 years or 15 years? How many billion-dollar babies, as I call them, go bankrupt? Anybody take a guess? And I'm talking about on average, so benign and stress cycles combined. Any guesses? Three. Thank you, Martin, for starting us off. Do I hear five? Do I hear 10? 10. Thank you very much, Luke. 15. Anyone? 15? 15? 20? Thank you, sir, way in the back. The answer? About 20. On average, this year already, it's about 15 or 16. And we're in, 3% or 2.5% growth rate. Unemployment is down to lowest level in 50 years. I wouldn't say our economy is booming, but it's doing pretty well. And yet we'll have close to 20 firms going bankrupt with a billion in liabilities. The rest of the world probably has close to zero. You know, it's a real event when a billion-dollar company goes bankrupt in Europe. It's staggering in some countries. Yeah, most of the countries are much smaller than the U.S., but still, $1 billion is a lot of money, and yet it's very common in the U.S. But there were no billion-dollar bankruptcies back in the 60s. Even if you adjusted for inflation, the average size of the bankruptcy in our sample was $25 million in assets, and if you adjust for inflation, it's probably about $150 million today, or something like that. And $150 million now is a pretty small bankruptcy in the United States today for many, many companies. the near extinction of AAA companies. So here's another question for you, just to make sure you stay awake. How many AAA companies are left in the United States? AAA being the highest credit rating. By the way, there are no AAA banks in the world. How many? One. Do you know something that I don't know? Well, I thought the answer was two. But I thought maybe somebody was downgraded today. So from AAA, who are they? Who? No, Berkshire Hathaway is not AAA. Johnson & Johnson, correct. And Microsoft, excellent. Microsoft, I don't know what Berkshire Hathaway is, but it's not AAA. Two. As a matter of fact, oh, before I show you the graph, how many were there in 1992? Or one, or three? Any guesses? Luke? 12, 15, 20, 100, 200? 99. We had 99 AAAs, now we have two. Now, why? Do you think that all these AAA companies have deteriorated in their profitability and their other operating over these years so they're no longer AAA? Well, some of them have. There was a big drop in 2010, 2011, after the crisis, yes. We probably lost a number of industrials then due to operating problems. Well, the main reason why we only have two left is the amount of leverage in the system. And boards of directors no longer want to be AAA. Who would want to be AAA unless you're a bank? Because if you're AAA, almost by definition, you have very little debt. That's the only way to have be a AAA. And if you have very little debt, who's suffering? Your shareholders. Because if you have less debt, little debt, and debt is cheap, you're giving up a great opportunity to borrow cheaply and reinvest at a higher rate and increase the return on equity. So boards now say, I don't want to be AAA. I don't even want to be AA. You know the most popular rating today? Take a guess. BBB. There are more BBBs than any other rating. And you know what's second? B. Not AAA, not AA, not A. It used to be, considered a prestige thing to be AAA and AA. You know, especially if you're a bank. If you got downgraded, if you were a bank 30 years ago, it was like a funeral. You know, everybody would be in mourning. But no longer, because AAA is no longer an optimal rating. And the main reason is that they've dropped so much is the increase in corporate leverage. And I don't have in this PowerPoint to show you how much leverage has increased, but it's enormous. Do you know there's twice as much corporate debt outstanding today than in 2007, just before the crisis. Yeah, low cost is part of the reason, the big part. But the other is companies are realizing that debt is no longer beautiful. Now, let me point out, some people ask me, just had an interview recently, what did I do that I most regret, especially with respect to the development of the Zed model? And I don't know if I regret it, but I realized I wasn't smart enough in 1966, 67, because I didn't determine the holy grail in credit analysis, probability of default. All we did back then is to say whether or not a company looked more like a bankrupt or a non-bankrupt company. We didn't say with what probability our estimate is that they would go bankrupt. But it became more and more relevant as time went on. And now it's incredibly relevant because all banks, for example, must estimate PD and LGD for every asset on their balance sheet in order to determine capital requirements. And PD is the probability of default. You cannot say this firm is more risky than that one. You cannot say this one has this rating or that rating. You must say with what estimate is the estimated PD and the volatility of that PD around that estimate to determine unexpected losses and LGD. So in 1989, we decided we better do something about this. And it was promulgated by a couple of things. First, in the 80s, based on being asked by Morgan Stanley to estimate the risk-return trade-off for high-yield bonds, I gave a couple of speeches afterwards on this default rate expectation in that market. And people in the audience would ask very interesting questions. One question was, well, you've told us what the estimate is of default rates on junk bonds, but what about double Bs or single Bs or triple Cs? I said, yeah, that's a good question, but I didn't have the data to do it. And then someone else would say, well, you've said that this company is likely to go bankrupt, but you haven't said when it will go bankrupt. So there's a difference between if it goes bankrupt in 6 months or 6 years. I said, yeah, that's another good question. So the usual professor cop-out is, let me think about it and get back to you. And of course, you never see the person again and you never have to get back to the person. But seriously, sometimes we do think about it. And I did, and I even talked to one of my colleagues who is a statistician and also a member of the actuarial science area, a fellow in actuarial science. And he said, you know, this issue of bankruptcy or default probability and when sounds like an actuarial problem. And I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, an insurance actuary estimates life expectancy based on certain characteristics of people. So one of the most important ones is gender. So the average life expectancy, for example, in the UK today, of a newborn baby boy is what? You tell me. Anybody know? 80, 78, something like that? Well, the US is about 78 to 80, same area. And a life expectancy of a newborn baby girl, 103. No, I'm only kidding. But they live longer. The bambinas live longer than the bambinos. Except in the finance industry. Very stressful. Women die very young. No, just kidding. But if the baby lives for 1 year, the life expectancy changes. And 2 years, and five, and 10. It's called contingent probability. Contingent on survival, you have a new estimate of mortality. So what's the relationship between people and bonds or loans? Well, there is something. But we don't have boy bonds and girl bonds. But we have gorgeous AAAs, beautiful AAs, handsome As, good-looking triple Bs, not-so-good-looking double Bs, ugly Bs, and downright disgusting triple Cs. Maybe we can use the original rating as a criteria for life expectancy and default probability. Now, you can criticize rating agencies, and I've done that over the years myself, but one thing they do pretty well, very well actually, is plain vanilla bonds and loans, original rating. Why? First of all, they've been doing it for 100 years. Second, they put the most resources, people and data, into that analysis. And they generally get a good idea about the rating. Now, that rating is a surrogate for likelihood of default. So PD is endemic to ratings, even though until they started calculating cumulative default rate tables, they didn't have quantitative estimates of the PD from the ratings, but they knew a AAA was less risky than a AA, which is less risky than an A, and so on. Not necessarily linear, but definitely lower or higher PDs as you went down the scale. So let's use that original rating as a criteria for expectation of default rates. But I'm not going to use the original rating. I'm going to use Z-scores in the following way. So first you have a credit score. You build a model. It's not that difficult to build regression or logistic or discriminant models today. You got the computer power, you've got the databases. You got to be careful about having the right database, the right variables, the right timing, the right industry if you can, the right country, and we've practiced that. But it's not that difficult. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to build models. Second, before you get to the PD estimate, let's assign a bond rating equivalent to the score. And this requires some sort of analysis like median scores by bond rating. So, for example, we do this periodically. The last time we did it is 2017, and you can see the hierarchy of scores by rating. So a couple of things jump out at you. First, you better combine AAA and AA because there's almost no AAAs left. Second, look at the B-rated category. What's the average score or median score? What is it? 1.65. Remember the zone? What zone does 1.65 fall into? Well, if you remember, right? The distress zone. So does that mean, and the distress zone, by the way, in 1968 was 100% accurate. Does that mean that 100% of Bs will default? Obviously not. Nobody could sell a B if that was the result. Take a guess before I show you the results. What is the probability of a B defaulting, say, over 5 years, cumulatively for 5 years? Any guesses?
20%.
20. That's a great start. Thank you. Do I hear 25?
25.
How about 30? Thank you, sir. And now I know in the back you're going to say 40, right? The answer is 28%. How do I know that? Well, we've created mortality tables by original rating, by rating over time. And the equations for calculating marginal and cumulative mortality rates are the same equations that an insurance actuary uses when he or she tries to establish premiums on insurance for life insurance. So the marginal mortality rate is the total value of defaulting debt from ratings in a particular year divided by the population at the start of the year. Very straightforward. If you have $1 billion of a certain rating issued in a certain year and a million or 10 million default, you have a 1% default rate. Or if they have 100 bonds and one default, it's a 1% default rate in that year. Cumulatively, the equation is 1 minus the product
survival rates.
And the survival rates are 1 minus the marginal mortality rate. So if the marginal mortality rate in a particular year for a particular rating is 1%, the survival rate is 99%. You multiply the survival rates over time, subtract from one, and you will get your cumulative mortality rate, and voila, these are the tables. Now, I wish it was a little larger so you could see it, but let me read it for you. And some of you with super good eyes maybe are able to see it as well. But if you look at the beat-rated category, you got to go to Asia to get really good pointers, because I can't even see this thing here. But we have the same problem at NYU. I can't see that anyway. So let me read to you. B-rated bond, year one, has a 2.84 probability of default.
How do I know that?
Well, over the last 40-plus years, looking at 3,454 defaulted issues, and we continually have this database at the Stern School that we update on a real-time basis. We look at every default that ever took place. If it was originally rated B, we then can catalog the default rate over time. And a B-rated bond, on average, has a 2.8% chance of defaulting in the first year. Cumulatively for 5 years, if you can read that number, 27.93% or 28%. So, this is a fact. You can't deny it. If you use an actuarial equation, and by the way, actuarial, the thing that's different than what we do than a rating agency is an actuarial rate adjusts the population over time for exits. So, if a bond is issued at B at birth, 1 year later, say there's 100 bonds, 1 year later, two default, maybe three are called in. You know, the biggest option in a corporate bond is a call option. And companies can call in. Usually there's a no-call period, and then the call kicks in. So you can exit for good reasons as well as bad ones. And there's sinking funds, and there's mergers where bonds are paid off. There are all sorts of ways that a bond exits, and we have records of that. So we adjust every bond by original rating for exits over time, and just the default part becomes the calculation of the default rate. And so 27.8% is the cumulative default rate for a B-rated bond. That means 72% do not default by the fifth year. So now you have to ask yourself a question. I mean, you don't have to, but I'd like you to think about it. If somebody asked you, is a portfolio of Bs a good asset class to invest in? Could you answer that question if I told you 28% will fail by the fifth year? Is that enough information to answer the question?
Interesting.
You want to know. Martin, what do you need to know?
You
want to know how you are being compensated for taking that risk. And instead of interest, let me quantify it a little bit, spread over treasuries. How much are you compensated more than the risk-free rate? Or the so-called risk-free rate. And I'll tell you, it's about 5.5% per year over time. Is that enough? What else do you need? I'm sorry, couldn't hear you. Could you? Volatility. That comes after, before the volatility. Yes, volatility has to do with being whether you're risk averse or not. But I'm just talking about an estimate, you know, expected value. Let's do that first, and then we'll deal with volatility. What else?
The price?
No. LGD. And what is the main determinant of LGD? Recovery rates. So I need to know something about how much compensation I'm getting for taking the risk, And also, if there is a default, what am I going to lose? And it turns out that the average corporate bond recovery rate is somewhere between 40 and 45%. And that's for all seniorities. Obviously, higher return recoveries for senior secured and lower for the junior unsecured. So we have tables for loss given default or mortality tables. And how much, can anybody see, how much do you lose for 5 years? 19.7%. Or let's round it to 20. So when your elderly aunt calls you up and say, I've been told that I should invest in single B junk bonds by my broker, do you think it's a good idea? You can tell her, well, you expect to lose about 20% of your money by the fifth year. But you're compensated by 5.5%, at least on the portion of the portfolio that does not default, each year for 5 years. So now you pull out your smartphone or your computer, and you compound 5.5% for 5 years. So I know that there's some brilliant people here, but if you need your smartphone, what's the compound return for 5 years of a annual spread of 5.5%? Anybody? How much? 29? Close. 27? No. 30.7. I think you missed by 1 year, Martin. 30.7%. So that's what you're earning more than treasuries. And what are you losing from defaults? 20. Differential is about 11% over 5 years, annually a little over 2% a year. So the expected return, net of defaults, net of recoveries, of a B-rated bond portfolio, and by the way, I can do this for any rating, is about a little over 2% a year, more than treasuries. Now, if you have a large portfolio and you're diversified, that might be good enough for you. If you're worried about volatility, then you might say, well, that's not enough for the fact that B-rated bonds are quite volatile. It turns out they're not that volatile. In fact, if you compare junk bonds in general with treasury bonds, you're going to find that treasuries are more volatile. Isn't that remarkable? Well, the reason is there's a difference in duration. So if you studied your bond math, who has a higher duration? Treasuries or junk bonds? Treasuries. Usually a couple of years more for a 10-year maturity. The reason is that junk bonds have a higher coupon, and you get your money back quicker. Anyway, the point I want to make is that you can use mortality rates, expected spreads, recovery rates, to do an analysis of every risk class that is out there. Turns out, Bs are far more profitable on an expected value basis than double As, for example. Why put your money into double A's? Why say, oh, I'm risk averse? Well, yeah, you're going to have less defaults, but you're also going to have a lot less return than if you put it into B's. I personally like double B's a lot, but I like junk bonds in general. I think the risk-return trade-offs are quite adequate. Anyway, betting back to how we estimate PDs, credit scores, bond rating equivalent, mortality statistics, and then recovery statistics to estimate PDs over time. And it turns out it's not linear at all. You can't see this too well, but the first year for a B is 2.8, and the second year is 7.8. Let's take double Bs. 0.89, 2.0, 3.8. It's an increasing marginal probability of default, particularly for junk bonds, for about 3 or 4 years, and then it levels off. Does that make sense? Think about it. If you buy a bond, is the likelihood of default in the first year different than in the second year? Well, I think you'd all agree it's different. Which is lower, the first year or the second year?
First.
First.
Just get the money.
You get the money, as Marchand says. The money comes in. You should have some left over to pay a coupon or two or three or four. But then you use that money. You know, you buy another company, you invest in a piece of equipment, you replace an old bond, whatever. And after a while, you're going to pay the interest only on cash flows. And that's going to be much more difficult to do than if you have a big cash stash left over from the original bond issue. And so we do observe this increasing marginal probability of default for about 3 or 4 years, and then it levels off. Yes?
How sensitive is this to the time period? This is from 1970 to 2010, but
good.
It's 10 years ago.
Yeah. Very good question. When I first did this analysis back in 89, the rates were lower. We've had several periods of stress since then. 90, 91, 01, 02, and 08, 09. By the way, these were fantastic periods to study defaults. I sometimes, my Shrine students have heard me say this many times, but I'll say it again. I love defaults. I love bankruptcies. As a scientist, we need data. And my wife and I have this tradition of opening up a bottle of fine red wine every time there's a big default. And if there are two or three in a short period of time, we move to the fine champagne. And in those years, I don't have the graphs to show you, but 90, 91, 01, 02, and 08, 09, we were drunk all the time. It was absolutely fantastic.
How are we doing?
10 minutes only. Okay. Let me give you some applications of the model. I have a bunch of examples, but I didn't realize I was talking so much, so I'll go speedy. But I want to tell you something. This analysis is not only good for bankrupt, non-bankrupt PDs, but let's take companies that never went bankrupt or you never thought that they would, and you could use it. Look at IBM. IBM, back in 1983, had a Z-score of almost 6, clearly in the AAA zone. And they were AAA. But every year since, they deteriorated until 1992, when the bond rating equivalent was B or double B, but it was still AAA from the rating agencies. Rating agencies do a good job on initial plain vanilla bonds and loans. They do a very bad job, in my opinion, on the re-rating of companies. They are slow, and they usually don't change the rating enough. And Herbert Ryken and I, he's a professor from Amsterdam, have done a number of studies showing how slow they are and how much they should be dropping the rating, for example, compared to what they do. The answer is they're about 1.4 years slow, and they dropped the rating by only 60% of what it should be. That's the results of our study. Yes?
Do you think that because the rating agencies are conflicted?
Yes, absolutely. They're conflicted, although they'll never admit it. And I guess, tell us why they're conflicted.
The company pays
for the rating, and the company gets a rating. So they're their customers. If they give them a lousy rating, they may not get that customer again. However, they do have a reputation to uphold to be competitive in the marketplace. But it's an oligopoly. And so oligopolistic, we know, have predative pricing, and they charge much too much now than they should. That's clear, because a lot of ratings can be done by a computer now. Or you use artificial intelligence, and the expert system can easily replicate 90-95% what a rating agency does. Sure, they have some secret sauce in what they do, and they say that's value added, you know, private conversations, some analysis that is not done by the market. Now, are they conflicted? Probably, but we don't have a better business model out there. I have some recommendations from that, but that's for another lecture. Let me talk about applications. Now, there is a table here. Unfortunately, I have it further. These are applications that I and others have suggested for the Z model over the last 50 years. The left-hand side represents applications done by analysts who are external to the firm. The right-hand side by people within the firm. Now, the left-hand side, some of them are pretty obvious. Bankers. Every bank in the world has a Z-score type model. They don't call it that. They build their own model. It's called internal rate-based models if they're a big bank. But they are basically variations on the same theme. They look at financial data. They might add some qualitative data. And then they come up with an internal rating. And they map the internal rating to external ratings. Unless they have enough history to estimate PDs directly from their own data. And that's the state of the art. Well, they can use Z-scores or whatever it is for pricing, for reserves, whatever. Bond investors, equity investors, long-short equity strategies, very commonly use Z-scores. And regulators, auditors, advisors, M&A, all types of external to the firm. The right-hand side, and what I'd like to spend in the remaining 3 hours that I have with you, right, 3 hours? The right-hand side, I want to emphasize maybe one or two. The first one on the right-hand side is to file or not bankruptcy. So whose responsibility is that in a company? The board of directors. Was it William Shakespeare who said that? To file or not to file? That's the question. Well, that's a real decision, important decision for the board to make. But sometimes the board is forced by certain issues. And sometimes to file or not is something of national importance, maybe even global. So I'd like to give you, maybe in the last minutes that I have, a personal story, anecdote, true story, about a small company that I was involved with called General Motors. And General Motors, you may know, was on the verge of bankruptcy in 2007, 2008. Indeed, it was the largest automobile manufacturer for many, many years until around then, and Toyota became the largest in terms of number of vehicles produced per year. And it was having serious financial and operating problems in 2008. Indeed, whoops, I want to go back. This table shows the Z score from 2005 to 2017 for General Motors, and the bond rating equivalent of what I talked about before. And the bond rating equivalent was basically triple C, B minus, and then D. The D being below zero. I didn't show you that quickly, but the new 1.8 is about zero, even though let's not have a zone, but firms that go bankrupt, on average, have scores below zero using the Z model. Now, here's General Motors. And on December 2nd, 2008, I received a phone call from the ranking member of the Republican Party in the House of Representatives. At that time, and again today, the House is majority of Democrats. Right now, the Senate is Republicans. But back then, it was both houses were Democrats in 2008. And the House Finance Committee, made up of about 70 or 80 House representatives, was holding hearings as to whether or not General Motors should be bailed out or not by the U.S. government. General Motors, being an American icon, having a major financial subsidiary called GMAC, was considered to be so important that the government was considering a bailout. And they asked the CEOs of GM, Chrysler also, and Ford, and the head of the union of automobile workers to come to Washington and pitch the government as to why they should be bailed out based on their restructuring plan. And they also asked a panel of, quote, experts to opine on whether or not they should be bailed out for, hopefully, objective reasons. And I was on that second panel. Sorry, I fast-forwarded too quickly. So they asked me, would I testify on December 2nd? And I said, well, what is testimony involved? They said, well, you have to write your testimony. It could be as long as you want, but you only have 5 minutes to present your argument, and then it's Q&A with the members of the House. And I said, oh, when is the testimony? They said, Friday. And this was Monday. I said, oh. I was at a conference in Florida, actually. I wasn't even in my home base. But I called up my graduate assistant, and I said, what's the latest Z score? And the latest Z score was 0.63 negative in December 08. Clearly, deep into the D zone. Plus, I'd been following GM for a couple of years, and they were hemorrhaging $2 billion per month for several months, and it was likely that that would continue because we were in a major recession, a major financial crisis, and GM being an operating company was also losing lots of money, $2 billion a month. So for many reasons, I argued, and I was the only one on the panel, that they should not be bailed out, that the only way to save General Motors was to go bankrupt. And you may find that hard to believe, but if you know anything about bankruptcy law, there are tremendous benefits to a company to go bankrupt. First of all, you don't have to pay your interest while you're restructuring. Second, there's an automatic stay on many other liabilities. Third, you can cancel certain contracts very easily, like leases and other contracts that you cannot do when you're not bankrupt. You can close dealerships much more easily than when you can do it, because dealerships in the U.S. anyway are sanctioned by state law. But, pardon the term, federal law trumps state law. And bankruptcy is a federal legislation, where state law on dealerships is state. And General Motors, by the way, had 5,000 dealerships in the U.S. Toyota, which was selling more cars, had 2,000. So it gives you an idea of how much wasteful spending there was. And a lot of the dealerships were owned by the General Motors itself. So I argued they should go bankrupt. The only way to save this company. Their restructuring plan was not very believable, we argued. I was not very popular. I wasn't exactly booed by the, maybe in the UK, they boo people when you don't say something in Congress that they don't like. They're a little bit more polite in the US. But I clearly was not very popular. And I said to my wife, who was at the hearings, I said, I don't think I did too well. She said, no, you did fine. They just don't understand the B word. We're not talking about liquidation. We're talking about reorganization, restructuring. I said, okay, fine, thank you. But they voted against me, and they voted for the bailout. But the Senate voted against the bailout for conservative and technical reasons. And the last thing that George Bush did, who was president at that time, was to say, I'm going to bail out GM and Chrysler one more time, but now it's Obama's problem. And it was. And Mr. Obama did a fantastic job in restructuring the U.S. automobile industry. He hired a lot of, he asked a lot of very competent professionals in the finance field to lead the restructuring. And they forced a number of CEOs to resign, but it didn't work so well because the new CEOs that were appointed were the old guard. And it's very hard for the old guard. This is something I've learned over the years in my restructuring experience. The old CEO who was responsible for the problem or at the scene of the old problem is psychologically and probably operationally unable to turn the ship around quickly anyway. It's very hard to fire the people you've hired and to sell the assets you've bought. And it oftentimes takes new management to do that, either interim or personal. That's why we have, at least in the U.S. and increasingly in Europe, a turnaround management industry. And they are mainly interim CFOs, CROs, CEOs, etc., coming in to do what's necessary when the old management usually cannot. Anyway, on June 1st, 2009, when the Z-score dropped even further, the happiest day in my professional life, GM filed for bankruptcy. I was euphoric. Oh, more than that. I was drunk for a week, not just a day. And by the way, one thing that I recommended back in December, and I don't know if you've ever heard of a concept called debtor in possession financing, DIP financing. You should hear about it because it's going to happen throughout the world. Slowly, it's beginning to happen outside the U.S., but not very much. But in the U.S., when a company goes bankrupt, usually, although not in 2008, usually there are a half a dozen financial institutions knocking on their door saying, won't you borrow money from us? Can you imagine that? One day before, they can't borrow a nickel. Afterwards, they can borrow hundreds of millions of dollars. The reason is the new lender, after bankruptcy, DIP lender, debtor in possession, has a super priority status over all existing unsecured debt. And the debt is always secured. You pay maintenance, you pay premiums over LIBOR or prime rate or whatever it is. And ladies and gentlemen, I tell this to my students, so I'll tell you, it's the biggest scam in finance. The reason, and I don't mean illegal, it's a big scam because you can count the number of times a DIP lender has lost money on one hand. And probably there have been 40 or 50,000 DIP loans in the U.S. over the last 30 years. So how's that for a success rate? And you're making all sorts of returns in doing it. We had there's a conference that I attended today at one of the hotels here, put on by DebtWire, and there was a session on what's called UTPs in Italy. UTP is unlikely to pay. It's a new concept in Italy. And then there was a panel on that and a panel on restructuring opportunities and investment opportunities in Italy. Well, Italy has experimented with debtor in possession financing, but Italy hasn't perfected the law to make a DIP lender super priority over all existing and to perfect the guarantees on secured debt. Long story short, it's not working in Italy. It's not the only thing not working in Italy, but that's certainly one of them. I love Italy. I go there all the time. You know, the pasta's fantastic and the people are great, but they're all screwed up when it comes to their financial system because of a lot of legacy issues that need to be changed. And one of them is to perfect this DIP financing idea. Anyway, GM, you see what happened to them. They survived. They're doing reasonably well. We think they are a B or B minus company. If you look it up, they're triple B today again, investment grade. But like a lot of other industries, companies in the auto industry, they're going to have a tough year in the next 2 or 3 years. And the bottom line is also going to be if we not only have, we already have a big drop in auto sales globally, particularly in China, and that's a big problem for Germany in particular, but there's going to be even worse if the U.S. and China go in, the U.S. goes into a recession and China has a big drop in its growth rate in the next, say, 2 or 3 years. That will prompt what I think will be a change in the credit cycle. We don't know how serious it's going to be, but it could be quite serious, mainly because of the enormous, enormous buildup in debt in the global system. I don't have the data for you today. It's the subject of another lecture, but this issue of debt buildup is gargantuan at the government and the corporate level, not so much at the financial institution and consumer level as much. Anyway, with that, thank you for your patience. I won't keep it to midnight. Thank you very much.